Welcome to the Pro Photography Podcast. It is June 6, 2023, with episode 202.
Welcome to the New Web Pro Photography Podcast, where we talk about what's new, what's old, and what works for professional and enthusiast photographers. Find show notes, videos, and more at simfx.com/podcast.
Me, your host, Gavin Syme, today as we continue to ramp up the comeback of the Pro Photography Podcast. The archives are actually in order. The show notes going up over at simfx.com/podcast. You can also still get there directly by going to prophotoshow.com. It'll forward you right to the page. And you can, of course, find the stuff I'm working on over there as well on the blog. I do a lot of blog posts. All the videos that I make over on my YouTube channel at Syme Studios that I often mention as well. So you can see a lot of the visual hands-on stuff that I may mention throughout our episodes. This week on the show, we're going to talk about getting better exposures in any situation, and I'm going to give you some really good tips that I've picked up over the past decade for really improving those. Because yes, it's coming up on a decade since the last Pro Photo Podcast aired, and that's my fault. That's my fault, but we're back, and I want to make this better than ever. That's why I'm taking our time. I have been reaching out to past guests of the Pro Photo Show 1.0. I've been chatting with people. We're, of course, going to do round tables and panels and interviews and all kinds of fun stuff. I think one of the things that always made Pro Photo Show fun is that there was a lot of variety. There's a lot of good photo podcasts out there, and there's the type that are really artsy and they're kind of this monotone, like, when I was a child and I first picked up a camera, I was very timid. And that's not to say that those are bad. It's just a lot of the podcasts are really focused on maybe doing interviews, or they're focused on film, or they're focused on street photography. And one of the fun things, being a bit of a maniac that me, Gavin, has always been, and most of our guests, quite frankly, we like to try things. We like to do different things. We like to talk about what's new, and we're going to do that too, because after the intro, we're going into the new photo news nugget, so we can talk about what's hot this week in photography, or what's cold, or what's pissing us off, and just talk about where the photography world is going. Then we'll get into our main topic. And of course, just like in the old days, I will wrap up the show with a gadget, a camera, or some kind of a pick of the week, just like we did in the old days of the Pro Photo Show. And I'm just taking my time because I want to do this smooth. I want the communication to be smooth. I want you guys to feel like the show is entertaining, organized, that we're not dragging, that I'm not just rambling. When Pro Photo Show started back in like 2006, there wasn't a lot of podcasts for photography. Podcasts were pretty new, and I was just doing it in front of my computer. I wasn't even a full-time photographer then. I was a floor covering installer in my family's business, my family's construction business. I installed carpet. I was just a kid. Life was simple and fun, and things were good. And I'm going to start reminiscing if I don't just keep moving, because it was a very different time, not only with me, but with photography. And as Pro Photo Show grew over the years, and I was a full-time photographer, and things were expanding, and I started teaching more workshops and improving, things came a long ways. And eventually, actually about a year after I stopped the last Pro Photo Show, I got my master's degree in photography from Professional Photographers of America. You guys know I've been working a lot studying with Kim Whitmire and wall portraits, and we always talked about all that on the show. I've done a lot of videos and podcasts about that topic. And Ken passed away in 2016. I believe it was 2016. And right at the end of 2016. Which was tough, because I was going to have Ken give me my medal for my master's degree at the PPA conference that year, and I really miss Ken. He was a great photographer, and we've talked about him a lot on the podcast through the years, and you guys have seen him in my various videos, like the history of photography, for example. I will link that video in the show notes. It's actually an excerpt from, hang on, making a note. It's actually an excerpt from my Photo Perfect master workshop, which is on my site and talks about, you know, how to really master line and space and composition. And a lot of those techniques in that I learned from Kim. But there's a chapter in there that I just put out there for free on my channel that's the history of photography. And it's me and it's Ken and just kind of talking about how we got where we are in photography. And if you don't know the history of photography, it's definitely worth looking at. Although I think there's podcasts also dedicated to that that are probably better at the history of photography than I am. Okay, let's move on to the photo news nuggets. Let's talk about some of the things that I've picked up on. And this week, as photography just grows and grows, the AI stuff has been huge. And a lot of you guys have probably seen videos talking about the generative AI in the Photoshop beta. It's pretty wild. Sometimes the results are too wild. Everyone's talking about how amazing it is. If you follow my channel, I actually just did a video that I'll link in the show notes about how horrifying it is and how some of the results are just completely insane. You'll tell it to do one thing and it will do something completely random and completely different and sometimes downright disturbing, which isn't to say that this technology isn't going to have a huge effect on photography as a whole. But I think that carrying on in this, I saw an article on Petapixel. And by the way, when I talk about an articles or specific news stories, I will put links, of course, in the show notes over at simeffects.com/podcast. But this was this camera that doesn't have a sensor. Now, it's not a commercial camera. This is like a weird thing with a GPS on it. And essentially, the camera pulls this data, it pulls the time, it pulls the weather, it makes an AI photo from where you are. So it's not a photo, it's not a camera, it's an AI generator. And I think it's more one of those just kind of internet experiments. But people like to fight right now about this AI isn't photography. And no, it's not. If you're taking an image and you're generating it from AI, it's not photography. And I think that's important. And I think this AI stuff is actually going to make real photography, regardless of the camera, whether it's film, whether it's digital. I think it's going to make authentic photography important. And we're going to do a show on AI. I think I'm going to wait until we actually have a panel that can talk about it more than just me. But I think authenticity in our photos, landscapes, portraits, not that we should never edit, right? If I'm editing a portrait for a client, I want it to look really good. And so I might use a generative AI tool to take out something and distract it in the background, right? I'm focusing on my subject. I want them to be there. But on the other hand, as I showed in my YouTube video last week, I can take a landscape scene and I can just modify it. I can make it a fantasy scene. I can add to the waterfall. I can move the waterfall over. Is this good for something like that? At that point, I think it becomes illustration. You may have started with a photo if you're using that particular tool. If you started with a photo, now it's like an illustration that was based on a photo. Okay, fine. But if I'm taking a landscape, I think it's going to be more and more relevant. For example, the Instagram story that I took while I was there taking that photo to show people that, yes, this is a real place. Not that there's anything wrong with being an illustrator. The dishonesty online right now with photos, with TikToks, I mean, almost everything you view in these short form videos is fake in some way, right? And you say, well, what's the difference? When we watch a movie, it's fake too. It's actors. Yes, but you know it's a story. You know it's actors. If you go to something like YouTube Shorts or TikTok or Instagram Reels, these things are being portrayed as real life experiences, right? Whether it's personal things or people taking photos. And oftentimes, they're completely staged and coerced. So how do you guys feel about that? Let me know. By the way, for each of these shows, if we have a panel, we'll comment on these news bits. But if we don't have a panel, I'll give my comments. You guys can go over to the show notes over on the site and you can leave a comment. There's a comment section on each of the blog posts and there's also a Facebook comment section on the blog post. So it's really easy to comment over there. Let me know what you guys think about these topics. And then we'll probably also have a post over on the Photography Shadow Hunters page, which I will link from the show notes. So the show notes are the go-to for each Pro Photography Podcast episode. Continuing on in the news, more with AI. On the one side of copyright is Japan is basically saying that images online are fair game and there's no copyright enforcement for AI. This, I know, brings a lot of questions and there's a lot of controversy about, right, this. And again, this is something I'll come back to with when we have a panel and we'll do an AI episode on this. But I want to keep reporting the news well on this, because this is kind of a contrast to what we're seeing in a lot of areas and lawsuits that are going on right now. And it does raise real questions. Like, yes, as a human being, you can view images online, right? You can absorb all those images, and then you can make a creation, a painting that's not from those images, and make something new, but maybe that was inspired by other images you've seen, and you're not violating anyone's copyright. But is AI doing that? Or is AI actually taking all these images, right? Because AI doesn't really make an image. AI knows what the Space Needle is because it's going to look at images that you and I have taken of the Space Needle, and then it takes the context of those. So how deep is that training model going? What does that mean for photographers? And it's also the result is not a photo. We'll talk about this more so I don't go too far down the AI rabbit hole. Let's talk about a little bit of new release type stuff. And I've seen a lot of people talking about the Leica Q3. I've seen some great reviews from the DP review guys that are now over at Petapixel and just kind of watching this. And as an avid street photographer, and I just did a pretty lengthy post about street photography because I always struggled that I never talked much about street photography on past Pro Photo Show because I never did a lot. You know, we did photo walks and things like that when we did workshops. And I really think there's a difference between a photo walk and street photography. I think your mindset, your perspective is different. And so I've really focused because I live down here in Mexico now, the land of magical light. There's so many interesting things, and it's so different for me, right? Not that we shouldn't do street photography in the town we were born in and get ourselves inspired. But when you're in a place that's completely different, the culture's different, and I do speak Spanish, and I walk the streets, and I'm seeing these things. There's just so much to see and so much to photograph, and it's honestly a street photographer's paradise. I mean, you go to the markets, which exist somewhere every day, right? And we're talking, you'd have to watch my videos to kind of see this, but there's an eclectic nature. The cleanliness of streets, the organization of rules and things like that is not the same as you would see in the US and in most European countries. Things are kind of very eclectic and by the seat of their pants, especially on the streets and in markets and things like that. And so there's so much opportunity for this. So we'll do a street photography episode in the future as well. But for now, I will link my street photography blog post that shows what I've learned in 3 years, my three top tips for doing really good street photography, and a bunch of examples from down here on the streets of Mexico. But I use my primary street camera now is a Fuji X100B. And this could be a whole episode in and of itself talking about that Fuji camera because it's a fixed lens, 35mm equivalent Fuji camera. And it's one of those cameras it's expensive, but it's small, you know, like a pro point and shoot. You can't change the lenses on it. And so when it came out, obviously this is the fifth version, but when I saw videos of it coming out probably 4 or 5 years ago now that it's been out, I was like, I wouldn't pay $1,500 for a camera that I can't change the lenses on. And then I ended up eating my words because when I started doing street photography, I realized the interchangeable lens thing. Yes, those are good, but the cameras tend to be bigger, right? If I'm on a full frame Sony, I don't really feel, if I feel more like I'm on a photo session, I draw so much attention. Then I could take a smaller Fuji camera. I also have like an X-T3 that I use for portraits and my fashion work. And it's a great camera, can change lenses on it. And it's not that big. It's fine for street photography. But when I got that X100, which is a very Leica rangefinder styled camera, that completely changed. It was a very inspiring camera to shoot with. And so I saw them talking about this Leica Q3. I've never owned a Leica, I admit. And so if you have owned a Leica or own one of these, maybe the Q2, I hope you leave a comment. And then you have the monochrome versions of these two. I saw this article on the new Pentax K3 monochrome. I wouldn't shoot an only monochrome camera, I don't think at this point. I should never say never, but I'm sure these are phenomenal cameras. But if I was buying a Leica, it would be the color version, of course, because I want the color channels. I feel like you lose a lot. Sometimes I'll even shoot film in color and then convert it to black and white, because when converting, I can have all the control over those color channels, the reds, the blues, the greens, the oranges. And I do that if you use either my free or my complete version of my Silver 5 black and white presets. I've been making those Silver presets all the way back since the days of the original Pro Photo Show, but they've come a massive distance since then using all the latest tools. I make them for Capture One. And there's a free pack you can find over at simfx.com/silver. I'll link it in the show notes as well. What I'm getting at, though, is if you look at the way I build those processes, or even the way that I do Photoshop actions. I make an action pack called Blackroom where I do Photoshop actions for black and white to do a more advanced edit, more atmospheric edits. And you can do a great black and white from a monochrome image. So I could take a black and white preset in Lightroom or a black and white action in Photoshop and manually edit and mix it up and get a great black and white photo. But by starting with a color photo, and I get this question a lot in relation to people looking at my presets, like, would these work on my Leica monochrome, or I'm thinking about getting a Leica monochrome. And I'm like asking myself, is this just a fad? Like, oh, it's cool, I shoot pure monochrome. No, it's not actually really pure. It's just the way Leica interprets a monochrome scene. So if I shoot in color, I get to interpret the monochrome scene the way I want. Now, of course, this Leica Q3, the normal one, is in color, and it looks like a phenomenal camera. It's definitely got that little classic rangefinder Leica. It's fixed lens. I mean, I think we could probably go out on a photo walk with it, or street shooting, I should say, and take that and take the X100V and do a side-by-side comparison. Who wins? Obviously, the Leica has more resolution. It's way more expensive. We're talking about a $1,500, $1,600 camera versus a $6,000 camera. And it raises a lot of questions. And everybody's saying, this is the ultimate street camera. Right now, for me, the ultimate street and travel camera is my X100V. Even though it's a fixed lens, it takes these phenomenal quality images. It has that very organic film rangefinder style dials and controls. It has optical as well as digital viewfinder. But I think there is something that I've mentioned in some of my street photography videos, and these videos are in that blog post I mentioned that I'll link in the show notes. These super expensive cameras on the streets, as street photographers, we're sometimes in places that aren't that nice, right? We're walking dark alleys at night. I mean, I'm frequently walking dark streets of central Mexico at 11 o'clock at night. And it's not that I'm particularly unsafe, but when you're carrying around a camera that's worth a year's wages, that's a lot to lose. And it's a lot to attract if somebody knows what that is. And I don't just mean in Mexico. I mean anywhere you're at, right? That's a lot of equipment. And maybe that's not important. You're like, oh, I have insurance, whatever. But you draw a lot of attention. Now, obviously, when people see my X100V, it's like, oh, that's a nice camera, right? They know this is not a crappy $100 point and shoot, because everybody takes photos down here, mostly on their phones, but people know. But a Leica is a completely different level. Would I like to have a Leica? Sure. But would I actually feel comfortable walking the streets and doing my photography with it? I'm not sure that I would. And that's something I've thought about quite a bit when I was out taking street photos. If I lose an X100, if somebody mugs me and takes the X100, I'm going to be pissed. And that's going to be painful. But at the same time, it's not a $6,000, $7,000 or more camera, right? And this is one of the cheaper Leica cameras. Wrapping up the news for today is the Nikon Z8 battery issue that we're seeing. And I do want to mention this because I think our right to use our products, our right to repair our products is really important. I saw a video about this from Lewis Rasmussen, who's a cellular repair guy, but you guys may or may not follow him on YouTube. He's a very strong advocate of right to repair and consumer policies where these electronics, car companies, phone companies, everybody, we don't have a right to repair. We don't really own anything anymore. It's all software. It's all terms of service, and they can just shut it down and it no longer works for us. That could, again, right to repair could be a whole episode in itself, and it absolutely affects us as photographers because everything's software driven now. But what caught my attention this week regarding this is this Nikon Z8 that people are saying it won't work with third-party batteries. Now, it seems to still be a little up in the air. Petapixel had an article on this. There was a huge thread on Reddit. And there was, of course, the Lewis Rasmussen video. And when he puts out a video on something, it gets a lot of attention because he's a spokesman in that area. And I'll just tell you right now, I never buy OEM batteries for my cameras. And I haven't in 20 years. I remember back in the days of like the 5D Mark II and people were like, you should definitely buy the OEM batteries. They're better. I would never risk damaging my camera. Why would I damage my camera with a battery made to spec that has good reviews and other people are using? Is it possible? I suppose. I mean, I've had both fail. They inflate, they get weird, they stop working right. I've had lots of OEM batteries fail. OEM batteries are not necessarily good. DJI drones, I've had numerous OEM batteries inflate and fail. Fuji batteries, I've had the aftermarket ones kind of inflate and they no longer even fit in the camera. You have to stop using them from heat, from time, whatever. And I'm like, oh, it's a junky old aftermarket battery. No, then a few months later, one of my original Fuji batteries does it. These battery technologies are still lacking. We're still trying to get there in the world of battery technology. It's still holding back technology and portable electronics in a lot of ways. If I say I buy this camera from Fuji, from Canon, from Sony, from Nikon, they don't get to tell me what brand of battery I can use. And there's no way I'm going to pay what they want for a battery, right? Especially down here in Mexico where batteries in particular tend to be a little more expensive due to importing and stuff like that. So a battery for my Fuji, I'm probably going to pay $75 for, or 1,500 pesos or more for one battery, when for the same price, I could get a pack of like four from a reputable aftermarket battery brand, like Neuer or something like that. And they work just fine. I've been using them for years. And so in the end, you can use aftermarket batteries or not. That's totally your choice. And if you say, no, I have this expensive camera, I'm only going to buy original batteries, I'm fine with that. That's okay. But it should be your choice. And so there's a lot of discussion on this new Pentax Z8. And we're going to wait and see. But some of these batteries are saying, you know, we won't let this battery run the camera, right? So the battery is obviously connected. It's powered on the screen and the camera. Think about this. It's using the battery to power on the camera to say, we're not going to let you use the battery. That shouldn't be tolerated. Now, is this an isolated incident? This is the problem. Because they can change firmware on these cameras years after we've purchased them, guys, and take away our right to use the camera for whatever reason. And we see this with a lot of software, you know, games that people have bought that they can no longer play because, no, we're shutting down servers and no one else can make a server or will sue them, right? So you see this everywhere from places like video games all the way to the cameras we're shooting with. And it's really important, I think, that we talk about this and that we have real conversations about what does this mean to us as creators? Do we own our cameras or not? What do you guys think about it? You let me know in the comments. Finally, one more article. On the one hand of the copyright thing, we have Japan, at least to some degree, saying AI models can train on any photos they want. You have no say in it. On the other side, you have Italy with their copyright completely off the charts and just letting it be abused, in my opinion, by the Galleria dell'Accademia in Florence, where Michelangelo's David is. And what happened with this is GQ magazine had this kind of special edition lenticular cover, right? Where one was Michelangelo's David in black and white on the cover of this magazine. And then as you tilted it, it switched to model Pietro Baselli in the exact same pose. So it was kind of like this superposition of the two. And so they sued GQ or Condé Nast saying, you can't use the photo of Michelangelo's David without paying us. And apparently these crazy courts in Italy sided with them. And they said that GQ was debasing, obfuscating, mortifying, and humiliating the high symbolic and identity value of this work of art. Now, I've looked at the cover. I'll link this in the show notes. There's a good article about this on Petit Pixel as well. It's totally not debasing anything from what I can see here. But this brings up this other question with copyright. And we've talked about copyright a lot in past shows too, and protecting the rights to our images. But on the other hand, there's some images that I will put out in public domain. I'll contribute them to free stock sites or to Wikipedia to kind of give back because I use those kind of things at times as well. So then you get to things like this though. This is a sculpture hundreds of years old. This Michelangelo has been displayed in this gallery in Florence since 1873. But they didn't make it. It's not their art. They're just displaying it. So if you pay to go into this gallery and you take a photo of this, they have no right to copyright this. Copyright is meant, the idea of copyright is meant to protect the energy and the effort that the artist put into something. That's why copyright has a time limit. It's not meant to protect the estates and eventually the galleries or corporations or entities that buy that piece of art long after the artist is gone from this world. That's not the point of copyright. So what's happening is copyright on certain areas is being completely ignored. On other areas, it's being abused. Disney does the same thing with this, right? Where they take their old stuff that should long ago have fallen out of copyright and been part of the culture, part of public domain, and they use lobbyists and manipulation and a lot of money to manipulate court systems so they can get a win. The gallery that displays the Michelangelo should have absolutely no right to the copyright of that image. Michelangelo created that for other people to see. Now, he's not here to speak about this, but if this is a piece of art created for other people to see, his time is long past. He's no longer here. People should be able to appreciate that in their way. And I honestly think this is pretty outrageous. And I don't think this kind of thing should be tolerated. Even though I'm an advocate for protecting copyrights, I'm also an advocate for them not being abused. And I think this is something that we should talk about more as well. But that's quite a bit of news for one day. I actually found quite a few things to talk about. I want to know what you guys think about these various news topics over on the comments. So head over to profotoshow.com to go straight to show notes for the podcast on my site. Let me know what you think in the comments or over on the group, and let's talk about this more. Let's jump right in to the main topic for the day. So on this week's segment of Make Your Photos Better, we're going to get into our main topic, and we're going to talk about making your exposures better. Now, if you go back to like 2011, 2012, when I did my exposed workshop, the exposed workshop was one of my best works. And even though it's not in super high definition 4K and the filming quality, a lot of it was shot on a 5D Mark II with modded firmware to shoot video. I mean, these were the early days of like this flexible DSLR video. And here we are in 2023 and I can take rock solid B-roll on a phone. But it wasn't that way then. Everything was manual focus, manual exposure. Even when I bought a cinema camera, it was the C100 cinema camera from Canon. Great camera, all manual. And we shot a lot of things. My brother Nathan and I, who helped me a lot of my projects of filming, we did a lot with that camera. And we made things like the Exposed Workshop, which is still on my site for sale. It was one of my best-selling products that I ever made because it covers basically every aspect of exposure and zones and things like that. And so when I come back to that, here I am a decade later, and I'm looking back at that, and I'm saying, no, you know what? I think I did good on that, because all of that information is still relevant. The fundamentals of exposures don't change. Have I learned new things? Have I learned to put more emphasis on shadows? Yes. Have I learned to visualize my zones differently and better, and maybe in a more flexible way, and not always be quite so rigid about metering exactly down to the third of a zone on everything? Yes, because when you're on the streets, for example, you need that flexibility. You have to be able to draw the line in your exposures. There's a time, if I'm shooting this gorgeous landscape, high resolution, I'm going to print it big, that if you can, yeah, get out your spot meter, whether it be in camera or separate, like the Pentax digital spot meter that I've talked about and showed you guys a lot of times in my videos. And that was one of Ansel Adams' favorite meters. And I still have that meter. It's a great meter. And you can meter and get exactly to the zones. And it's very powerful when you start understanding the stop and the zone, which are one and the same. In fact, this is something we will be talking about in my Shadow Hackers free workshop coming up on my site. I do these every now and then, like webinar workshops. And there's one coming this Thursday. So if you go over to simeffects.com, you'll see info on the upcoming workshop there on the site. And if you're listening to this after, check out my site and see when my next Shadow Hackers workshop, because I have a lot of different workshops, but that's kind of my overview of shadows and zones and how to see light better and go a little deeper visually than what we can talk about today here on the podcast. But what I want to make a note of We'll do a shadow episode another day. There's this idea of like, oh, we should expose to the right, essentially overexposing. And I've said for some time, and I did a video recently about ETTR on my channel saying, don't expose to the right. That's wrong. Expose right. And I caught some flack for that. And I don't need to explain it all because you can go watch the video if you want. And I'll put that video on my channel in the show notes. But in essence, overexposing makes you far more likely to blow out pixels. In fact, when I'm shooting the streets and when I started studying more of the great street photographers and great art and thinking like, what's different? Why do I sometimes go out, whether it's a portrait or a street session, and there's no life to it? It just feels flat. Well, we're in the era where we can turn up shadows and highlights and HDR, right? And I'm a big fan of natural HDR. I've made my natural HDR presets for many years that kind of emphasize pulling out HDR, but keeping it contrasty, keeping rich shadows and doing a balance. I was there, if you guys remember, in the early days of HDR, when we used great apps like Photomatix and stuff like that for tone mapping and fusing and merging the images together, which with the dynamic range of cameras today, I rarely need to do bracketed HDR. I almost never do it because if you process the raw file right in post from a modern sensor, you can get a phenomenal amount of dynamic range. There are exceptions to this. And I know there's some of you out there still bracketing your HDR, and there's nothing wrong with that. But I don't bracket my HDR if I don't specifically need to for something, because if I process it right, I'll get the dynamic range out right in Lightroom. And that's what my natural HDR project that I still have over on the site has been about all these years. But when you think about that, I want you to take that HDR image in your mind that we often see kind of this overcooked, overbaked feeling photo, right? We've all seen the nasty HDR. I had some skits and jokes way back in the day, and we talked about this a lot when HDR was young, and it's matured a lot now. And my most mature high dynamic range scenes are just from single files. And you would look at them and say, wow, that's like an HDR scene. But no, I just exposed it well. And that's why you normally don't need to bracket for HDR. Because we think, oh, we're painters of light, but actually it's the shadow that kind of defines our light. And I have whole videos and stuff on this that go deeper into it. But in essence, to improve your exposure, you need to be thinking about what it is you're exposing. Where are you placing not only your light in relative to zones, to stops, right? But your shadows, especially automatic cameras, they want to lighten everything up because it's the trend, right? If you take a photo on a phone, everything's kind of lifted and lightened. I'll switch to like pro video mode on my Samsung because the video actually looks way more natural. It's not trying to lift up all the shadows. It's less noise. Dark things look dark. When you expose, don't expose to the right. Unless you specifically have a need to, right? Are you blocking up in the shadows? I would much rather block up a little in the shadows than have pure clipping 255 in the whites, because that's unrecoverable. Sure, you can paint it in Photoshop. Another video about that on my channel is fixing blown highlights. I will link it. You know, we can use the AI masks. I keep mentioning these things, and now I have to make notes of them. Fixing blown highlights. I have a video specifically on advanced fixing of blown out highlights in Photoshop where you're actually painting over details and stuff to bring those back because sometimes you need to, especially if you're exposing to the right. You're going to need to a lot because if you expose 2/3 of a stop to the right, you're unwittingly going to end up overexposing a lot. And you say, well, I'm bringing back into the shadows. But why do I want to do that? Since I want to darken those shadows back to where they were in the first place. I want shadows. And even some pure black shadows, if you look at photos from the greats, from great street photographers, from the Ansel Adamses, from the Stieglitzes, like rich, deep blacks, they may have been the nature of the film that was being used, but it worked. Even if you go back to painters where they could make it light, they used a lot of darkness and shadow because it lets you see the light. It's the same in portraits. If you flat light a portrait, I have this problem a lot. And I've had kind of a fashion portrait project that I've been working on for the past couple of years to improve my natural and artificial lighting, to improve my working with models and to challenge myself. And so you may have seen a lot of photos about that on my blog and my various videos and things like that. What I learned in doing way more portraits instead of just doing them occasionally, I mean, there was weeks where I had 4 or 5 sessions a week with aspiring models down here that we just went out and did photo sessions. No one was getting paid. And I was just practicing with them. So there was no pressure. We were just experimenting with photos. And I really started to realize like, no, you can't just light one side of the face and expose for that and say, okay, I'm going to expose the face and put it in zone 6 or 7. You have to have the right fall off. You have to illuminate the whole scene. You have to darken things down where they should be dark and lighten them where they should be light. But if you just do this, and you see this a lot, and I've done this a lot of times because it's so easy to lighten up shadows. If you take a relatively flat lit portrait and then you go in and you turn down the clarity and you smooth it with a Photoshop action or a portrait plugin, and everything's lit and it just kind of looks like paste. It doesn't feel organic. It doesn't feel real. It feels more like AI, even though it's a real person. And so I've had to push myself and remind myself a lot in exposure how to make better exposures. The first thing to make better exposure, and let's get down to the actual tips of it, right? The first thing to make better exposures is not exposing everything the same. Don't try and make everything lighter. Don't always expose up. If you need to expose the right because you're losing shadow somewhere and you know you can bring it back in post, fine. But generally, I would say choose your subject, like I've talked about for many years in my videos and in my expose workshop. What's your subject? Because if you don't know, you shouldn't be pressing the shutter most of the time. What is your subject? There should be one. It should be the focal point of your image. Where do you want the tone value to be on the subject? Ask yourself that simple question. How light or dark do I want the subject to be? Now, you can talk about, you know, ratios and do I want more light on this side of the face or less? Or there's a person walking down the street. I'm going to wait till they walk into that ray of light because I want them illuminated at this level and everything else darker. At that point, I'm underexposing. The camera is going to try and expose everything bright, but no. And you see this all the time in iconic photography, particularly black and white, but not just black and white. Start looking at this in street photos. Some of the best street photos are clearly underexposed. When I use the word underexposed, I don't mean exposed wrong. I just mean by a standard of a meter, which is always based on, a light meter is based on middle gray. It puts everything to middle gray. And then, of course, these advanced meters that we use today are taking different points based on middle gray and averaging it out if they're doing evaluative metering to determine an exposure, right? The phones are doing the same thing. But the meter itself, the light meter, is still taking a baseline reading of middle gray. So if you spot meter and do exactly what it says, you're going to come out at middle gray. This is something we talk about in other workshops, and actually we'll be talking about in this free webinar I have coming up next week. What I'm getting at here is that you should never let the camera decide for you. When I'm out on the street, and one of the reasons I like the aesthetic feel of my Fuji X100V, it has a very good exposure compensation dial. Now, when I'm on the street and things are moving, I can't stop, put it on a tripod, pull out a spot meter for the zones, and put it in there. But I can look at the back of that histogram and know where my zones are falling. I can see where what zone my highlights are in just by looking at a histogram and what my shadows are in, my midtones, right? So I can see my zones just based on my histogram to a relatively accurate point, not as accurate as precisely metering on an exact point. You have to decide with the type of photo you're taking. I have to actually get the shot. With street photography, it's all about soul and emotion. I can't stop and figure everything out. The shot will be gone. But I can use the knowledge I've learned from studying zones, from studying exposure, from looking at that histogram, from even looking at the preview on the camera to say, no, everything's light. I want everything dark and only that person walking through that ray of light dark. So what's the quickest way to do that? I have no fear of using manual mode. But a lot of times what I'll do is I'm already have the camera up to my eye. I'm just going to crank down that exposure composition dial and put it a stop below, stop and a half below, two stops below. I'm almost never exposing to the right when I'm shooting street photography. I use the word expose to the right. That's a technique where you overexpose to get more shadows, right? And then you balance it out in post. So you're essentially overexposing. But when I say use exposure compensation, I'm really not talking about over or underexposing. I'm talking about not allowing a camera to expose for me. I'm deciding where those tones fall. That's first. That's the number one way you can make better exposures, is not be afraid to use an exposure compensation dial or to use your manual settings, whether they aperture, shutter speed, ISO, etc., to darken and lighten things up. What looks good? I know the preview on the back of a camera screen can be deceiving. That's why I use the histogram. And then I know how that histogram relates to stops and zones, because these are basic fundamentals of exposure. Stuff that all, if you've never studied zones in relation to the histogram and things like that, don't feel dumb, because this is stuff that should be the basics in every photography 101 or photography 201 class, but it's not, because most of the photographers out there don't know zones and stops and how they relate to histograms and digital. And this stuff is important. And that's why I give this information away for free. If there's a magic bullet I could give you, it really is like start exposing up and down. Not that you should bracket everything. I'm not actually talking about bracketing, although that can fit in there sometimes. I'm talking about when you're out shooting, actually look at what your histogram is doing. Actually look at how light, right? You're taking a portrait of somebody in the park. All the trees are the same lightness in the park as the face of the model you're shooting. Is that what you want? If that's what you want, that's fine, but it's probably not. You probably want to key down your background. This, of course, is done by the amount of light on the subject and then exposed for the subject, and so the other things fall back. This is where strobes come in, but the same thing is often done on street photographers where you see this shaft of light going across between two skyscrapers and a person going between it. If you just let the camera take the photo, it would probably overexpose that. But in this great photo that you might be thinking of, and I know you've seen a photo like this before, what's actually happening is the exposure was pushed darker. It was compensated darker. And there's many ways you could set up for this. But when I'm on the move at an event, at a wedding, on the street, I have no problem running in aperture priority mode and just using the exposure compensation dial. Because this is another thing too, is I think sometimes we think we have something to prove. Like, oh yeah, I never shoot in program mode. I always shoot in manual mode. I have nothing to prove. I've been a photographer for 20 years. I shouldn't say I have nothing to prove. I want to prove that my photos are good, but I don't need to fit in with a trend of like, oh yeah, I'm not lame. I would never use P mode. Of course I would. I will use absolutely whatever mode gets me the photo I want, but I'm not letting the camera do all the thinking for me. I'm putting the camera into the mode where I can control the exposures in the best possible way for the situation I'm in. Sometimes that just means full manual. I have the time to work with it. I'm light metering. I'm putting exactly in zones down to a third of a stop. Other times it means I'm on the run. I'm shooting, but I'm taking the time to pause myself in my mind for 2 seconds and say, okay, how light do I actually want my subject? And because I know zones, I can visualize that quickly and say, I want the subject in zone 5. I want the subject in zone 4. I want the buildings over there in zone 2. And I've been doing zones for long enough. And if you apply zones and stops, histogram, exposure guides that relate to those, this will become automatic. I promise. It's so powerful and it absolutely changes the way that you see everything. So if you want to make better exposures, see the light coming through your lens and don't be afraid to ignore what the camera and the meter is telling you. Expose for drama. Expose for the soul of what you're trying to create. What are you feeling when you make a photo? Does it feel dark with a ray of light shining through it? Does it feel high key and light? Decide what you want. See your subject. A lot of making a great exposure really does come back to knowing what your subject is. And a lot of photographers take a photo and they don't really know what the subject is. Just take a half a second and say, what's my subject? What am I doing with it? How light or dark do I want it to be? What's everything going on around it? Very simple questions that soon will become automatic, and I guarantee will let you make better exposures. And one way to wean yourself into that and just kind of understand it a little better, if you don't use everything I'm talking about today, if you haven't dug into zones and things like that, is to use the exposure compensation dial. Some cameras have an actual dial. Some ones you have a menu for it. But if it's a dial, if you have a dial, like, use it, because it's so organic and natural, and I think you'll find it's very powerful. And just see what happens to photos when you expose up and down. Sure, in post, you can turn up or turn down exposure, but it isn't the same. It isn't the same. Try to get it in camera and then edit well in post. A good photo in camera becomes a great photo in post and an amazing photo in print. A mediocre photo in camera never gets past that good photo stage in post because it was never well executed to begin with. And that is what I think, just kind of some 101 tips for better exposures. But definitely head over to the site and look at the links I'm going to put in the show notes to various things, including my Shadow Hackers free webinars, where we have Q&A on this and we look at examples and things like that, because I think that's going to help you even more. Exposure doesn't have to be complicated. You need to simplify it in your mind, and then you'll dominate every aspect of it and just keep getting better and better and better. Okay, I don't know how long this podcast has gone. I feel like we're actually at full podcast length now. And for this second episode in the series, where I'm still kind of getting a feel for everything, I'm feeling okay. You guys let me know how it sounded. Did I ramble too much? Am I under control? How do I sound? How is the overall topics, the order of the way we're doing news and main topics? By the way, pick of the week. Yes, my pick of the week is going to be something very simple, but I think you're going to like this. It is a USB-C LED flashlight. Now, I'm going to link one in the show notes. There's probably different ones out there. You know how some of the times this import stuff changes brands and stuff right now. The one I picked up a couple of recently was the Pick and Roll rechargeable flashlight. But the key here is USB-C rechargeable. A lot of these good LED flashlights over the years, and I've used these in my photography quite a bit, especially these type where you can zoom in and out. So they kind of the barrel of them kind of slides in and out, and you can focus or you can do a broader light. Is it the same as putting up a softbox? Of course not. But you can use this to light scenes. You could use this to bounce light off a wall or a white surface or a light-colored surface to fill a scene. You could even direct light into somebody's face. Yes, it'd be a little bit harsh. I've also used this, though, for light painting. Things like some of my aspens in the night photos from years ago that did well at international competition. Those were some of those early creativity challenges that I put on myself that helped me get my master's from PPA. And I would take an LED flashlight and paint trees and stuff like that. What I find about this and why I think it's really good is I've always struggled with the batteries. You can get a lower power flashlight that's just like double A's, but the more powerful ones have those 18650 laptop cells. And I kind of hate those cells. I know they're versatile and they do a lot, but they have a huge range of quality. A lot of them are total junk. They fail a lot. Good ones can be very expensive and difficult to determine which ones are real and which ones are counterfeit, etc. And in this age of USB-C, I want everything to be chargeable by USB-C. A flashlight like this, I can just have in the side compartment of my cars all the time. And I don't have to worry about taking that battery out and charging it. Does the battery still work? Because I'm just going to every now and then plug that into the charger, the same charger I'm using for my phone. And not only is a flashlight in your vehicle or in your gear bag a good survival tool, even though, yes, I know cell phones have flashlights, but something like this is way brighter. You know, we're talking about basically at a 10 watt or so LED on most of these mid-size LED flashlights. This particular one, I think, claims to be about 900 lumens or something. They do tend to lie on these flashlight numbers, but I bought it. It's very bright. It's very good. The zoom focus is good, and it's USB-C rechargeable. So it's not only a good roadside safety device, it's a very useful photography tool. And these things only run about $20 US dollars, even a little less. I will link to this in the show notes so you guys can check it out. And that is my pick of the week for this week. With that, I think we will wrap up today. I'm going to pull all this together and go into the editing floor. I shouldn't have to edit too much. I just have to cut a few pieces and a few silent points out when there was trucks driving by and all that. And I hope you guys enjoyed this second episode of the Pro Photography Podcast 2.0. I hope you guys will subscribe and whatever your favorite podcasting app is and spread the word so we can kind of get this moving forward and keep doing more and more exciting things here on the Pro Photo Show. And I hope you guys will head over to my site, simonfx.com/podcast, where you can find the show notes and links to all this stuff. I have been making notes along the way, so you can go find links to pretty much everything, every news story, every product, every side video, because now we have something more. I didn't have the YouTube channel fleshed out in the old days of the Pro Photo Show podcast. Now I have such an archive of videos that I've made that are just free to watch on my channel, whether it's Lightroom, whether it's Capture One, using presets, using actions, exposing better, using zones. And so when these things come up, I can then reference these videos and I'll just put them on the show notes for you guys and you can go check them out. So I'm kind of excited because it's a lot of years that are starting to come together, a lot of years of studying, research, and documenting technique. And I feel like as we're making the show here and recording the show, that it's starting to come together and we can actually put this to work to help us be better photographers. Please leave a comment, or as always, you can send me an email directly, profotoshow@gmail.com. That is all for today, and we will see you on the next episode. I'm Gavin Syme, and this is the Pro Photography Podcast.